The Last Word with Matt Cooper. Today FM.
Neil Jordan, director of The Crying Game, Michael Collins, Interview with the Vampire, Mona Lisa, The Butcher Boy, Breakfast on Pluto, and many more I could go on about, is with me in studio. Neil Jordan, thank you very much for coming in to The Last Word. You've just released, I'd hesitate to call it your autobiography, it's called Amnesiac. It's not quite the traditional memoir.
It's a memoir, all right, isn't it? It's what I remember, you know, and I never thought I would write this, but the publisher asked me and I began writing the first chapter and, you know, it kind of became interesting. So then I thought I'd continue, but I don't consider it to be an autobiography really, but I think it is a memoir, yeah.
Yeah, it's got some fascinating tales about your life and career, particularly in Hollywood, but also growing up in Ireland and that Ireland that you grew up in, a very socially conservative Ireland. I think some of the themes play out in some of your movies as well. If you were to contrast some of the things that happened growing up in Ireland, that you were probably ahead of your time looking at some of the social issues, particularly when it came to The Crying Game, The Butcher Boy, Breakfast on Pluto.
Maybe. But I've never really made a movie that is about Ireland as such, except for Michael Collins, you know. But I've never made a movie like, for example, like, it's hard for me to, like My Left Foot, for example, you know, that would directly relate to my memories of growing up around Dollymount. I haven't done that, you know. I made The Butcher Boy because Pat McCabe's book reminded me so much of the insanity, of the kind of rather beautiful insanity of those times, you know. And I made Breakfast on Pluto because it reminded me of, you know, a brief time I was kind of homeless on the streets. I wouldn't call it homeless. I had a home on the street, yeah, in London, you know. And, you know, so I've referred to these things in movies, but I've never made a movie about my own actual experience. I wouldn't know how to do that, really.
Let's reflect on some of the stories that you tell in the book. And one in particular, I think, will stand out for many people, which was that John McGahern, widely considered one of Ireland's finest novelists, was briefly, for a period of time, your teacher in school. But yeah. You talk about how he came to the part school, a very controversial issue at the time.
Well, he used to teach us, yeah, in Belgrove, over in Vernon Avenue, I think it was. I forget where it was. He used to teach us there. He was a country guy, as most teachers were. We were all city kids, you know, and John used to open the window and stare out at the schoolyard outside, you know, while we were doing our work. And then one day he just vanished, you know. Nobody knew why or how. He just gone. He was replaced. Nobody explained it to us, but apparently he had married a Finnish lady. Not only had he published a banned book, they didn't object to that, but it was the fact that he'd married a divorcee, apparently, that scandalized the community. So he was thrown out, you know. And John wrote about it himself. And I talked to him about it at one stage, actually. And he wrote a book called The Leave Taking, where he describes the parish priest, Father Carton, who I remember, and the headmaster, you know, at Belgrove Primary School, a guy called Kelleher. He describes really exactly and how they fired him, yeah. You know, and I asked my father about this, who was the kind of school inspector at the time. And he told me an interesting story. He said, no, that they didn't want to. Because to fire a national school teacher, you'd almost have to have an act of parliament, you know. He has to be fired for a reason of gross immorality, I suppose. But The parish priest was the patron of the school, who didn't want to fire him either. But the parents of Clontarf, you know, this little suburb I grew up in, came en masse to the parish priest and demanded that this man no longer teach their, you know, beautiful kind of sanctimonious children. So poor John was.
Maybe
my father's memory is wrong too, but that was.
This wasn't the Catholic Church. This was the parents. This was
no,
people,
no. That's
Irish
that's
people.
when I read about the kind of oppression of a 3.5-4 million or 2.5 it was then of an entire population by rigid clerics in black suits and by nuns and dun 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 dun. Dun. I always think of that story. I go, hang on, no, everybody wanted that. You know, they all conspired, you know. If you passed a church on the 30 bus, the entire church would, the entire bus would bless themselves, you know, the whole bus, you know. Sometimes they would bless themselves when you didn't even know you were passing a church because there was a church beyond in Ballybrack or somewhere, you know, that kind of thing. And, But I mean, that's why it seemed to me to be there seemed to be a symbiotic relationship between the weird society there was at the time and the people who lived in it, you know.
Let's talk about a good bit about your career now, because a lot of people, of course, remember the hugely successful from the early 1980s onwards. But The Crying Game, Interview with a Vampire set you on international stardom. Can I talk about The Crying Game for a bit? Because a truly genre-defining movie, very relevant themes these days. But the financials behind it, you mentioned in the book that you brought it into the orbit of the Weinstein brothers. And this was a hugely successful movie, but perhaps you felt that they came off the best from that.
Well, they did. They came off the best from everything, believe me. You know, I mean, I think maybe Quentin Tarantino is the only guy who made money out of a relationship with the Weinstein brothers, you know. But, you know, you speak to the makers of, say, Shakespeare in Love, you know. I mean, Harvey never let anyone get away with a penny, you know. And it was particularly injurious, or particularly upsetting on The Crying Game, because everybody had they had deferred their fees to make that movie because we had so little money to make it, you know. So an entire crew, the cameraman, the costume designer, you know, the set designer, the set dresser, the actors, me, when you all defer your fees so the movie can be made, and then it makes, I dread to think how much money it made. I know it made a lot in the United States and a lot throughout the world, you know. You kind of say, well, shouldn't they partake in this bounty, you know, and it happened. I don't think they did, really, you know, so that's what upset me with Harvey. That was before the sex crimes and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, Hollywood, a very different place from somewhere you grew up as well, but coming into the orbit of people in Hollywood, you met the likes of all of the big stars, but working with the likes of Tom Cruise, Brad Pitt, what did you make of Hollywood, your entree into it?
Well, I thought it was very, I liked it, because I was in Ireland making movies and nobody seemed to understand what I was doing, you know. I would go to London. I was part of the British kind of independent film world. And again, but that was kind of an outlier in a way, you know, to the world of, big world of television, the BBC and ITV and all that. It's only when I went to Hollywood that I met people who actually had spent their entire lives doing what I did, you know. So I found it a fascinating place, found it a very interesting place. And, you know, they were a very welcoming place. You know, they would welcome, you know, a young untried talent like myself, you know, but they just wouldn't want to do what I wanted to do, you know, and that's always been my problem with Hollywood, you know.
How do you get them to do what you want to do?
You accidentally make a bunch of money for some guy like Harvey, you know, and then they say, oh, come on, what do you want to do next? Or you make a movie like Interview the Vampire, which takes $500 million worldwide, you know, and they say, what do you want to do next? And I say, well, you have this script in mind, Michael Collins, how about that? And they say, we're not sure, okay. And they let you go at it, you know.
Can we talk about Michael Collins for a little bit? Mm. Because there are a couple of interesting bits in the book you talk about, and possibly the scene that got a lot of controversy at the time you talk about. It's the one where Michael Collins and Kitty are talking the night, is it the night before the big massacre? Yeah, you wrote that scene, but many people assume the dialogue is actually real.
I wrote that dialogue, and it's weird. It's become part of the folk memory, particularly the political memory of Collins. I've heard at the Michael Collins Memorial thing in Béal na Bláth every year, I've heard government ministers quote those lines. I think I've heard Taoiseach quote those lines. And I think,
which is the one, give us our peace.
We've had enough of your past. Give us our future. Give us our own country back to live in. Stuff like that, something like
fantastic
that.
Lines, but they're your lines, not the one.
Well,
not
I mean, I had to write something, you know. I mean, I couldn't quote, the entire movie couldn't be from his quoted letters and his, you know, his quoted dialogue, you know. I mean, the thing is, the treaty scenes, which we shot not where the treaty debates happened, the treaty debate scenes, those entire scenes, every word in those is from the record, every single word, you know. And that's why some of them sound a little bit corny, you know, that kind of thing. Because people spoke in corny ways then, you know.
Were you expecting the British backlash to the movie?
Yeah, in a word, yes. That's why we didn't put it in the Cannes Film Festival. They wanted it, and I was worried about the British press, because I knew that the possibility it was made by Warner Brothers England. It was supported by this wonderful man, Julian Senior, who just died about a couple of months ago, sadly. Julian was one of the best people in the film business I ever came across, you know. And but I felt if we showed it in Cannes, the British press would be all over it, you know. So we delayed it and showed it in Venice, you know. And, you know, we won two Golden Lions, one for the movie and one for Liam's performance. So it was a wise decision. But, you know, some aspects of the more kind of Tory British press were never going to like this film. You know, some aspects of the Irish press were never going to like it either, you know. So, but I mean, that was the kind of movie it was, you know. I mean, you can't avoid controversy with a film like that.
Controversy abroad, but also controversy a little bit at home with the performance or the portrayal of Eamon De Valera.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, I can't imagine a better portrayal of Eamon De Valera than the one Alan Rickman gave. I really can't, you know. And Alan, of all the characters in the movie, quoted most from the historical record, you know. I mean, he delivered Eamon De Valera's Rivers of Blood speech. Most of the speeches of the Sinn Féin cabinet, you know, during the War of Independence and even after that were from the record, you know. So I thought Alan gave an extraordinary kind of account of Eamon De Valera, you know, his high, reedy voice and his kind of nitpicking kind of brain and stuff like that, you know.
And there's several chapters in your book called Movies I Wish I Made, and one of them was you wanted to make a movie about Dev.
Well, you know, I would love to make a companion piece to Michael Collins, you know. For one of the reasons I would love to make it is because I wrote an enormous, there was a huge section of the treaty negotiations set in London that we just hadn't got enough money to move the whole production to London, so I had to take them out. But if I was ever to make a movie about De Valera, you know, I would begin there with his refusal to go to London and his appointment of Collins and, you know, people as plenipotentiaries and all that sort of stuff.
Of the movies you've made, obviously lots of them are such well-known here in Ireland, set in Ireland. Are they the ones that you look back on now as the ones that you think, I'm so proud of them? Yes, I've made Hollywood blockbusters, internationally successful movies, but is it A Butcher Boy, A Breakfast on Pluto? Are they the ones you really
care? No. I mean, it's not that really. I love a movie I made called The End of the Affair, which, you know, with Ray Fiennes and Stephen Ray. Even some movies that nobody went to see, I made a movie called In Dreams, a crazed kind of horror film that didn't do too well. I love that, you know. I like a movie I made with Isabelle Huppert called Greta, you know, and with Stephen Ray again. Yeah, I mean, it's hard to say. I mean, I suppose the movies where you were given the the financial means, you know, were appropriate to the ends are the happiest one to remember. Like, I suppose a movie like Mona Lisa, we had just enough money to make that movie correctly. A movie like The Butcher Boy, I had still had a deal with Warner Brothers. Insanely, they gave me quite a hefty budget to make this small rural Irish movie, you know. So I had the means to kind of bring the fantastical nature of the novel and of the script that I'd written with Pat to life, you know.
Very briefly, what's on the agenda next?
I have no idea. I'd like to. I'm trying to make a film based on the last novel I wrote called The Well of St. Nobody. It's very hard to raise financing at the moment because nobody's going to the cinema for independent movies. So the world out of which I made those kind of films is kind of, it's not quite vanished, but it's kind of gone into a cupboard for a while.
Well, hopefully we'll see it on the screen sometime soon. Neil Jordan, your memoir is Amnesiac. Thank you very much for joining us on The Last Word.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
The Last Word with Matt Cooper. Weekdays from 4:30. Today.